What you are about to hear is part one of my podcast with Jacob Blomqvist. Jacob and I had a great and lengthy conversation, and because of this, we felt better to divide the podcast into two episodes. The first, in this one, we will concentrate around Jacob's path in science, and the second, we cover the topics of martial arts, particularly Aikido, and its interplay with his scientific career. Jacob is a lecturer at Malmo University and a fifth dan Aikido practitioner. In this episode, we concentrate on his path through science and his work on surface chemistry, DFT calculations, the chemistry of water. Although Jacob and I know each other for many years, I actually have never heard in details about this part of his life. So I tended to listen and enjoy, and I hope that you enjoy it too. Without any other delay, I present to you my conversation with Jacob, part one, science. So, well, first of all, Jacob, thanks a lot for joining me. It's I actually am really looking forward for the conversation today.
So
it's great to have you, and also great to have the cat around.
Yeah, and now, just because you said that, I'm sorry to say, now he's by the door, and of course being very pesky and saying, now I want out again.
Yeah, so I'm take the cat out. This shows this is life, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, it should be a sketch. All of this should be just be one big sketch. It is already a sketch, I'm sure, but this nonsense is always...
Yeah.
Everything
yeah, it is. So, basically, the first thing I wanted to quickly do is basically introduce a little bit how we met, because that was for me at least quite a funny part of our relationship, because you do science, right? So now you are a lecturer, I guess that's the right term, in Malmo University.
That's right.
And we met because you actually did your PhD in the same department where I ended up doing my PhD.
That's right.
Exactly. And what it was very odd is that I remember your face because you were probably sort of traveling around, you know, the department. Yeah. And we probably even talked one or two times. And then, you know, you went your separate way. I didn't see you again because that was my time as a master student.
Right.
And then I saw you back at the dojo.
So that's, yeah, I think that's right. And I'm one of those who, it was probably easier for you to kind of remember me than the, you know, the opposite. Because you came in as a kind of junior and I was just almost on my way out as a PhD. And obviously, you know, it wasn't super big department, but it was still big enough that it were quite a, and you know, it was enough PhD students and master students that you didn't have check on everyone there.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you were gone for a while, or like we didn't really see each other for a while. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What could it be? 2-3 years or something? I don't know. Maybe, probably something like that. Maybe I can't remember. And then, obviously, we met in the dojo, in the Aikido dojo. And again, most likely, I had that kind of deja vu. Like, who is this? I recognize his face somehow. But I can't remember if you, you figured it out first or...
Yeah, I think I figured out probably after a couple of interactions, because also there's something about martial arts and the fact that, you know, you are wearing a gi. And you also present yourself in a different way, right? Because, I joined the dojo. I was, I was just starting my Aikido day. So I was just a student. And you're presenting there yourself, you know, you are teaching
not necessarily... I was probably teaching a class or something like that too.
Correct. So. And then also I think the other thing was because you were in a slightly, in our former department in chemical physics in Lund, each group is slightly independent from each other, especially the group where you were on.
Right. I was an odd one out in that department as a whole. You were more like a mainstream than in a sense than I was. When you were there, I believe I was the only one under my supervisor.
Yes.
So, and doing things that no one else, like everyone else were kind of doing the same thing and I was not. So, yeah, that's true. So I was kind of on the fringe and therefore probably more like, who is this guy versus everyone else? Yeah, it makes sense.
So the first thing I wanted to ask you very quickly would be to say, maybe if you can just tell me actually what is the area in which you do research? Because I'm very interested in talking to you about two things and the relationship between them, right? So one of them is you as a scientist, which I met you first, and then even if it was shortly, and then you as a martial artist, which we interacted a lot more. So within science and research, so what is exactly what you know, how would you define your field and what you like to do, let's say?
Interesting question. It's been like many other things in my life, it's been a very non-linear path from the beginning, from the time I did, even from my undergrad days, and like not really having that sense of this is what I want to do and this is what I'm passionate about. I was very much a jack of all trades. I started in math and then I ended up doing more chemistry. And from the chemistry side, I crawled more or less into physics, but stayed in chemistry. And then I did a couple of summer jobs, oddly enough, within chemistry department, at various institutes there, various departments, which was kind of cool. I needed the money, obviously. And then the last one, 2002 or three or whatever that summer was. Was with a supervisor that was later going to be my PhD supervisor, unbeknownst to me then. Obviously, it was just a summer job at that point. That summer job was to grow titanium dioxide films on dental implants. You can say dental implant material, commercial ones. And prospect future ones. So we were supposed to grow them and do some kind of analysis on them using this to me a very cool facility back then was called the Max Two Synchrotron facility. And that was cool. It was like it's a summer job. It was an odd summer job to say the least, but it was pretty say straightforward. So I did that, and that I was already very close to finishing up my undergrad. And after that summer job, obviously we were supposed to write up some kind of report for the company that had hired or had, obviously given the money to do this work. And that report, we at some point it just like, why don't we just make that into your master or magister exam work, your thesis for your master. And it's like, oh, what do I care? It's like,
Why
sure.
not? Yeah.
Yeah, why not? I don't know. It's like, and I had some courses left, but why not? Because you were allowed to do that way, and then you could finish up the courses. So I did finish that. And because of that, we actually added a little bit more. We had to be a little bit more than just a summer job. So we added a little bit more. I got a little bit more tighter connection with that supervisor, and then finished up some coursework. I think it was like, more higher level organic chemistry. What do I know? Maybe some other physics course as well. And at some point, I can't remember if it was before or after, but at some point when I was finishing up writing the actual thesis for that master, and then obviously having to present it as a real thesis on the within the department, then my supervisor asked me kind of pretty bluntly, actually. It's like, don't you want to actually ask this question? Don't you want to do a PhD? And I was like, well, I don't know. The same thing again. I really didn't have any, yeah, right on, man, I'm going to do a PhD. I didn't also not like dislike the idea. I just didn't have any real plans, and I didn't see myself as, maybe smart enough, as high achieving enough as an academic. But yet again, sliding in somewhere, and we made it work out so that I ended up getting a position as a PhD at that department, which was then already then called chemical physics, which you ended up being in as well. We were upstairs, fifth floor, on the other side of that building before we moved on to when I think you never saw that part. You only saw the newer part, if I
Yeah,
remember.
I when I arrived, you guys had already been moved to the new part,
To that
and you
newer,
have
newer.
joined because I think you
Right.
guys were in different places before.
Right, we were in different places, kind of, different corridors, and they were in the fourth floor, and we were again, even to really make it sure that we didn't belong. We were like further up north and they were a little bit different. But I have all, from my personality feeling, I've always felt pretty close to the other ones in the department. For me, I was very social in general, and there were other PhD students, so and master students. So I always felt that kind of need to be more with them, or just be with them, as and felt connected as a within that department. Anyway, fast forward, I got the PhD, did a lot of research. Then was more in-house stuff, not so much Max Lab in the beginning, and the research focused on surface science stuff. So it was, which was obviously similar to what I had done as my master's stuff, but it was still basically my supervisor was very hot shit in the surface science topic of having a metal surface, ultra high vacuum. Back then, it was that's what you did. And then you put something on it, like it could be molecules or whatever, and you looked at those molecules with some technique. Usually, it was infrared spectroscopy, or some kind of reflective spectroscopy, which was what he did. So he had that very pretty decent equipment, a ultra high vacuum chamber that he had, if I remember correctly, built or set up in Harvard when he was a postdoc there, and then moved that back to Sweden. That's the third PhD student, I think, in order after that,
All right.
to work on that equipment. So that's what I did. When I joined, there was another PhD student with under him, and then I kind of came in on the tail end of his PhD, so that we did have an overlap, which was nice because then I could kind of be trained in with that or trained with that work. So I did some experiment on pretty standard back then, the surface science experiment on molecules, on copper surfaces, on tungsten surfaces, and so on, using infrared, mainly infrared spectroscopy. And then as a sidekick, pretty early on, my supervisor had colleagues up in Uppsala, in Ångström Laboratory or Ångström Department, whatever it's called. He knew from maybe way back when he was a student, I don't know. And he ended up one that colleague of his ended up being my co-supervisor because we were in the same field. They happened to be very hot in the Max Lab. Back then it was called Max 2, this different facility. And their main boss was someone called Siegbahn, which is the son of the one who won the Nobel Prize of that particular technique. So they had a group under that, and under Sandel was his name, and he became a supervisor. So whenever they went down, and they almost had like a direct link to get beam time at Max 2, one of those beam lines there, they needed workhorses. So I would join in on that job or that work, and I lived in Lund, which they didn't. So I could kind of work all hours and then just go home and sleep and go back, and they had to sleep at some kind of hotel situation instead. And I would do that for two, sometimes 3 weeks straight. Those kind of back now it looks kind of straight. Nowadays, if I'm doing 5 days at these type of facilities, it's a long time. But then it was like 3 weeks. And it was nice. It was a very intimate situation.
Yeah, and also I think that may be something here for the people that don't realize it or have not worked in cyclotrons of what these beam lines. They need to understand that this is when you have time, you need you to use it.
You
Like
need
there
to use it,
is
right?
yeah, there is no time to waste. So if you are
24/7, 24/7. So
correct.
it's really like because it's at real money. Normally, I mean, you don't normally you can say that you pay for it, but at least the way that works back then at Max 2, you applied just like you apply for a project, like you get a VR grant or anything. You had to apply to get a time, or usually a week or maybe two if you're lucky, to do some experiment at a beam line at one of these facilities. And there are a bunch of them around the world nowadays, but still, it's a big deal to apply. You have to present a project and you need to kind of know what you're doing. And then you get a time to do experiment. And yeah, you really need to be there 24/7. If you're lucky, the beam is going all the time. So you make use of it, which also usually mean that you tend to be a group of a couple of people so that you can use all hours of the day and night. But it was nice because again, I was there in the beginning, very early in the beginning when I was there. The PhD students before me, he was also still around, but then he left. He finished his up, and the group from Uppsala came with two, three, four, sometimes four PhD students, or so on. So I became very friendly with that group and learned the crafts, if you like, of doing experiments using a synchrotron facility like that, and in particular X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, and that light and that type of experiment. Again, surface science. So it's having a metal surface. We would do a lot of things where either would grow some kind of oxide, or we just had the surface as it is. The silicon wafer was very common. You know, it's like classical for for this for semiconductor business. And then we would do add a dye, some kind of color dye of some form, and study the dye, how it would sit, how it would transport electrons, and so on, if we could. And
but
this kind of
this is almost like impurity level, right? So you have
right.
a very, very low amount of the molecule of interest on this surface
right.
that you really know, right?
So depending on what experiment we did, we would have, sometimes we would take out the sample, we would transport it in some kind of vacuum situation very quickly, or, you know, some kind of argon atmosphere into a glove box. We would do what we needed to do. It could be particular to add that dye, which was just a, you know, a suspension. You add it on, or you spin coat it, or whatever you did. Then without exposing it to air or anything, somehow you managed to bring it back to some transport or translock interlock system to get it back into the ultra high vacuum chamber without breaking vacuum enough so that you had to redo everything. And then you did the measurement. That would be one type of experiment. Another type would just be to have, again, a silicon wafer, a titanium wafer, and you would you would heat up a metal, let's say gold or whatever, copper or some metal, gold was a favorite, and you heat it up until it started to, you know, vaporize and then hit the surface. You could create monolayers of that and again use that to put something else on and look at that. So it's a lot of different projects. There's a lot of different PhD students with their project. And that guy, my co-supervisor, who often led this experiment, he was so slick. He would always contact people so that, hey, we're going to do a 2-3 week stint here now in Lund. Do you have something that you want to check on? So we had, like, you know, sometimes 10 different projects. If something failed, we just start bringing something else. So the time of my PhD, I was so lucky because my name was in, I don't know, 15 papers, because every time you did an experiment at this place, if you knew what you were doing, it would lead to some result that were publishable. Of course, we were maybe 5 to sometimes 10 people on a paper, no, 5-6 people at least. But never mind that, it was still a lot of paper. And as an academic, that's cool shit. So
yep.
That was my odd journey there, and I really feel like I had anything to do with it. I just kind of tagged along. I did do some stuff that was mine, and you could call it mine. In the end, when I was finishing up my PhD, by the time in the end, I had started to do density functional calculations as well, some kind of quantum mechanical calculations as well, to complement some of those measurements that I did with the infrared. So I ended up doing almost half of the time doing calculations, half of the time doing measurements, and finding some kind of nice window where both of those match the same level of understanding or same level of information. But we didn't really have a good, like, what is your topic? You have been doing all this kind of stuff. And it was a struggle to find what was my topic. But we looked in all the different papers, and the particular ones that I were more involved with than anything. And the last job that I did, which happened to be on infrared, it was this kind of fluke, again, this very random thing. Can't remember how it ended doing. We were starting to put water on a substrate. It happened to be copper. It could be anything.
Right.
We did it on copper in 70, whatever, 4 Kelvin. So it's very cold, you know, liquid nitrogen cold. So what happens is you put in water in the vacuum chamber, and it hits the surface. It's so cold that it just instantly, it doesn't freeze, but it gets stuck and then forms this amorphous layer. So you get a film of whatever thickness that you like of an amorphous level, or amorphous solid water is called. And who cares about that? Well, we didn't really care about it. It was just something someone else had done. But then at some point I found a little peak in my infrared graph. And that I realized, it was so lucky. I just kind of like, what is that odd peak? Everything else looked like normal infrared peaks, very blobby. It's water, so it's very broad and wide. But there was this one small peak. It was very sharp and quite small. And I realized that it belonged to those water molecules that were on the surface that were poking out towards vacuum, because they didn't have anything to connect to. They didn't have hydrogen bonds that they connected to
So
that
in this case,
created this.
you mean the hydrogens were pointing up.
Right. So let's say, yeah, hydrogens were pointing up. So of course, since they're pointing up, infrared basically looking at the vibration of bonds. So that's the way that you look at the vibration is you use the infrared light. And so they would detect those particular bonds that were like poking up without being bonded to other water. That's everything else was water, like bonded to. And because they weren't bonded, they became basically gas phase sharp. Because they were there, but they were same time they were stuck. So they were only that, you know, those you knew. Okay, what does that mean? That means that we have a probe of the top molecules of the water of in that film. However thick it is, we know that that peak represents the top. So then we start to play around with isotopes. So you know, we have heavy water. We play around with oxygen 18 isotope instead of 16. Just to shift that peak position in the infrared, just to play around a little bit with it. And then we start to realize that when, again, a mistake, when I was cleaning the surface, at some point I used a technique called electron bombardment. You just bombard it with electrons to just to heat it up and just kind of make everything blast away. But what happened with the electrons, instead of just heating it up normally, is that it broke apart the water molecule. So you ended up, it turned out, we didn't understand that in the beginning, we ended up getting a couple of hydroxide groups, so OH groups that were left stuck, a couple of them that were stuck on the surface. And the reason why we realized something was wrong first, we thought it was that when we made a new film, it behaved very differently. So we made two layers, like one of heavy water and one, let's say, normal water on top of each other. And then we started to heat it up, and suddenly the peak that corresponded to heavy water would kind of go up to the top very quickly, much faster than what you would expect or what we saw before from just pure diffusion, how it kind of traveled around. So it didn't make any sense. Like, why suddenly would it move so much faster? And we realized, oh, did you heat it up wrong? And what did you do? And I realized I had use this bombardment to clean it up, which it ended up being that I had formed some, not a full monolayer, but something of this, you know, broken pieces of water on the surface. Those broken pieces, those hydroxy groups, would end up enabling proton transfer. So within the kind of network of water attached to another water and so on. So if it's just pure water, it had no choice to kind of move around in its own way, and each they don't really ch exchange protons. But because you had broken the chain, if you like, you have formed some half water, you had already made a possible an opening for one transfer there, and then the next one. So it became like a chain moving around. So it opened a kind of an interesting experiment to just look at how fast does proton transfer through these type of solid ice, solid water. It became very fundamental research instead of just surface science. It was almost the surface in this case were kind of irrelevant. It was just became a way to do this experiment, and it became very elegant, much more elegant than I could take credit for. But it was just so lucky, and I felt so proud. I was like, how did you do that? It's like it was just everything was luck. So I remember it was the
Well,
proud.
it was luck and it was observation, right?
Yes, of
Because
course. And you know how it is sometimes. It's easy to say luck, but yes, you do need luck, but at the same time you have to, you know, take advantage of it as well. But one of the most proud moments I had was when the opponent of my when I presented my thesis that ended up having water as some kind of that became my thesis, like because I had done a couple of
So
water
water
things.
became the connection, basically.
Right, the water, because I had done some stuff at Max 2 together with the group and looked at water as well. So it was enough to kind of find that as the main thing, or at least a major thing. And all the other, you know, enormous amount of papers I had been my name on, it just became a side package. It's like, yeah, well, barely, you know, I was just a workhorse here. It was not my stuff. So I had my water paper plus one or two other things as my thesis. And then the opponent, she said, I can't remember if it was, we had a meeting, you know, before the actual defense, and we just discussed, but I think it was actually during the defense, and she's like, she highlighted that work that I didn't have time to publish, but it would end up being published later. But it's like, this was a very, you know, I think she called like very elegant work, because, and I agree, it was like, wow, of all the things I actually could put my stamp on, it was very elegant. And we did a lot of theory and we did modeling to kind of figure out what happened here. It was luck, but it was also kind of unique to find that ability to probe this and this and that. And that was that. And suddenly I was done with my PhD. Went to Japan for like kind of a vacation with my wife. It was a very nice time there as an Aikido, as we come later. It was very nice to go there, mostly as a Japanophile almost. 2 weeks vacation and then back to the department because I didn't know where else to go. So my, as it happens, for a lot of people, when you're done, if your supervisor has a little bit more money, you're not finished with your stuff. You need to write it up. It's like, oh, I have some more money. Why don't I hire you to stay and finish up the work? And that's what happens a couple of months. And then I applied for, I was so tired of academia. Right. And I did not want to have anything to do with what I did. Like, you know,
Were you tired with what? Were you tired with the project itself? Were you tired with academia in the way of like you didn't want to spend more time like doing again research on something so basic, or what was it when you said you were tired?
You know what it was? It was actually looking around in Lund, Lund University, and wherever else I happened to be visiting. Looking around at that kind of posh university setting, which is Lund University is pretty harsh, and the department that we had wasn't maybe, well, it was pretty up there it was renowned, world famous for especially the stuff that you did actually, but more but in general it was, you know, it was pretty good stuff, and Lund University is a pretty good place. I was looking around and I couldn't see myself to be one of those people, you know, like my supervisor. I couldn't see myself being him.
Right.
Doing nothing but looking, you know, writing grant application and never have that stability. And, you know, the last half year, you know how it was. Like you ripped your heart out to get your papers ready, to get your thesis ready. You hated your work. You wanted to just have it over with. I mean, in that sense, of course, you were proud of it, but you also, enough already. You know, you just wanted to finish it. And once you finish it, you kind of felt like you almost want to distance yourself a little bit away from it because you were so fresh. It had been so intense. I slept some days. I never went home, particularly when I was writing up this last stuff. And I just couldn't see myself because I didn't understand that academia could be something else. I only saw that part of academia of saying like, all right, am I passionate enough? First of all, am I passionate enough about my topic or what I could do so that I find it's part of the process. It's just something you accept because you're still passionate about research enough. You know, particularly then after that process. And B, can I see myself being successful enough so that I found myself having a chance to push through in this kind of very competitive, you know, to get a position in some kind of tenure-esque way in Sweden. I couldn't see myself. I didn't really, so I was very quickly, I was like, nope, I'm going to go in industry. I'm going to get a normal 9-to-5 job. And what happens? Do you think we got one? No, no, we are overqualified and all that kind of crap. So I did look for quite a lot of jobs, and quite often I was like the one out of two, and I never ended up catching the break. I was really lucky. The same PhD student that was just ahead of me, he had gotten a postdoc at the Danish Institute of Technology just north of Copenhagen, DTU, in Lyngby. At a very well-renowned place, world-renowned place, just a physics department, I think they call themselves there. And it's divided into a kind of a experimental side and theoretical side or calculation side, but they were also doing quite a lot of surface, mostly surface related topics. But they were only doing calculations. They were only doing DFT calculations, and they were very much involved with developing code and so on. I just knew about it. It was him. He was doing that stuff. I hadn't really any real sense of what was going on. But somewhere, I don't know exactly how it happened. Honestly, I can't even remember how it was initiated. But my... I just can't remember how, but after my PhD, I had this really awesome presentation of my work by the opponent. She had done this beautiful presentation of my own work. But as I asked her, can I get your presentation? Can I use that? It's like as a PR, you know, magnet, right, when I'm out looking and trying to explain what I did. It's like, yeah, she was a wonderful person. And somehow I ended up being invited to give a talk about the work,
right,
at that place, at the place of my postdoc, let's say. And I didn't think more than, well, it's going to be a talk and they might be interested, but it's just a talk. There was mm-hmm. no other ideas of that it was going to lead to anything. So I went there. So it was kind of a hassle back then to go to that end of northern end of Copenhagen. There was no tunnel or anything like that, so it took
forever. It was not particularly easy.
It took like an hour and 45 minutes door to door, which is mm-hmm. it sounds crazy, but that's how long it took. And but anyway, it was just a kind of presentation of your work, and it got me to see somewhere else, and it just kind of get me out of my head. I went, and I basically took her presentation, and I of course added my own twist to it, but I presented it, and on the spot they hired me just like that. So I was like, what? I didn't even have that. It was not on my agenda. I mean, maybe somewhere in the back of my head, it would be nice.
You were not even thinking that there was a job offer on the table.
Because you know how it is. In order to get something, you tended to have to actually apply for your own money to get a mm-hmm. postdoc somewhere else. That's the standard procedure. You apply for money, or you apply to a postdoc position, la, la, la. If you're lucky, you have money, and they basically take you because you already come in with money.
Right.
But no. They hired me to do a 1+1 year postdoc. That was at least the idea, at least. And the guy that had come before me had just left. So again, but this time I missed him. So he just finished off, and I went. Maybe that's why they wanted a new one, and they liked what he had done. So maybe they thought I was going to be as good. I don't know. But I went there, and it was an eye opener. For two reasons. The professionality was just, you know, staggering in terms of everything. The staff, the other, you know, PhD students, but also other postdocs and the professor there. It was a almost completely a research group. They had no undergrad at all. I don't even know if they were involved with anything. They only did that part. They had so much money. I mean, the professor there was incredible at managed to get all kinds of grants that were big enough so that he could, you know, do these kind of things, and they could build up this group and basically just focus on research. So me as a postdoc, I didn't have to do anything. I just could go in there and try to learn the craft of being, in this case, learn the craft of doing DFT calculation in a new way compared to what I've done before. And that's what I did. So I felt like, well, I don't know anything, but at least someone think I can do something. And I went there, and I learned a new way of doing these types of calculations and to build code. So they basically were the top of the game, and they were the ones creating this code, but it was an open source project. So everyone in the world were helping out, but it was stationed there. And I, again, so lucky. Just then, 2008 or 9, whatever it was, there was this new rage going on. Obama had just become president, and you know, bear with me. He was really progressive. So he had given a lot of money to new energy and sustainable energy research and so on. And one of the most hot topics were new types of batteries, and battery technology in general. And there was this new up-and-coming research field where you had, it was called lithium oxide batteries. So instead of having lithium ion, you had on one hand lithium, and the other electrode would be basically the air that you could kind of, or oxygen from the air. So it would be an interesting combo. That was something new, and no one had really, it was just very fresh, and it was really up and coming. And that professor that was responsible for everything at that place, he had a nose for this thing. So he kind of realized, this is, if we can get a foot in here and we can do something here and we can publish something first, then the sky is the limit in number of papers or number of citations that he's going to get. I have no idea. I think everyone else are busy, but he picked me. So there was no other reason why he would pick me. I did a little bit of stuff before that came about, and it went all right. But then that came up, I was like, he probably frantically looked for someone who could do some calculation, because he needed to come up like that very
Right, so
fast.
and you were the chosen one with free time.
R
Kind
I don't
of.
know. I guess I was just there. I was like, what do I care? I just do what I was told, basically. And I was happy to be told to do something, actually, because at that point I felt like, again, someone who came in and looking around, what am I doing here? I'm surrounded by these brilliant people, and I'm just learning. And he just like, oh, Jacob, can you do these calculations? And I did, and I did it together with a couple other people, but it was me and another one, basically. And I had almost nothing to do with the publication of it, in the sense that I didn't choose where it was. All the professor, he knew exactly how to do it. It was supposed to be a communication, something that goes out like within a week after all this kind of stuff. We went out, the paper came out. It was a calculation on how the mechanism would go about in these type of batteries, and it was the first one. So obviously we wanted to get it published. Everyone else needed to cite this paper whenever it came about, some kind of mechanism or whatever. So I'm still getting asked to go to China to talk about this paper every spring, every fall. It's like, can you we've been recommended, you to you seem to be very hot in this topic. It's like, I haven't done anything in this topic since 2008, but sure. So then we got pregnant 2009, and I was like, oh wow, well, I felt pretty good about myself. I had a very well-paid job. The paycheck there was like, having been a PhD student, it's like,
Yeah,
woohoo!
right.
It was awesome. And then we got pregnant with our first child. We had been married for a couple of years already at that point, and my wife. And so everything was good. And then everything was good. And then it was horrendous to commute. It was like, it's a hopeless commute. Oh, an opening comes up in Malmö University. It's like, what? I don't know, man. What is Malmö University or Malmö, whatever it was called, Högskola? They needed someone to do PhD, DFT calculations. And I felt that I wasn't the best, but at least I could do it now. I've been schooled, basically, or trained more and more into this. And I got a job, or some type of project, postdoc type of money that had come into this group at Malmö, that they needed to do this. And it was already 1 year after they were supposed to start. It was a 3 year project, and they had not managed to get anyone. And then I can't remember how I saw it, or if they asked me. I honestly can't remember anymore. But somehow I was, through a phone call, it's like, I can take it if you want me. It's like, yes, come. Very odd, everything. I don't know if it was kosher, but whatever. Yet again, I was suddenly hired into Malmö. It was, 1 hour, 45 minute one way became 20 minute door to door. It was
Right,
beautiful.
because your family was still stationed in Lund, basically.
Right. So we still live in Lund, and we still live here to this day. And compared to you guys, you moved around.
Right. Yeah,
So
but
then
then
that was it. And then I thought I was going to do DFT calculation. Nope. So I went there, and I obviously had my background in experimental stuff, especially with the synchrotron. And the project that this was supposed to be part in was something called well, it was looking at hydrogen embrittlement in zirconium or titanium alloys or materials. Both of those metals have a tendency to bind to hydrogen and form a chemical compound called hydrides, which is not unique, but there are not too many of the other metals that wants to form hydrides. Lithium is another one, for example, but not too many. Most of the times, hydrogen just is the smallest, of all the atoms, so it just kind of wanders around in the matrix and wreaks havoc or just makes it slightly less strong. But in zirconium and in titanium, in particular, they form a chemical compound called hydrides. And because they do that, they form grains and they become very brittle. So the material tend to be much more brittle and it can form cracks. So the money they had received was to investigate hydrogen or hydride embrittlement in zirconium and titanium. And it turned out there was a co-project between the nuclear facility group in Sweden that have zirconium as a cladding material around the fuel cells.
Right, so that would be the application,
That would be
basically.
the application here. So
Right.
they obviously have zirconium alloy or zirconium-based alloy to clad the fuels in the uranium oxide, whatever. And they don't want those to crack, and obviously,
Obviously,
so
yeah.
yeah. So that was one of the partners. The other partner, I believe, was Volvo and Volvo Partnership, which happened to be someone who were doing engines for the rockets. They
Okay.
were involved with doing rocket engines. And rocket engines have a lot of components in titanium, and because of its strength and lightweight and all this stuff. And again, we have a condition, as you might know, in rockets, you would have hydrogen. Hydrogen and oxygen will be one of the main fuels in some of the rockets. So you would actually have an environment of hydrogen to begin with in around these components. And so they became the other industrial partner, if you like, in this very big project that I was sucked into. Okay, so what? Well, when I was sucked into this, as when they hired me for this, they had a little mini conference, if you like, or a mini meeting where they had brought in a guy who was very good at doing measurements, the diffraction-based measurements using neutron and again synchrotron, but diffraction in this case. Of this type of stuff. And he was also in particular pretty well versed in the business of hydrides and so on. So they had brought in this guy and he was giving a talk, and they asked me, I wasn't yet hired, but they asked me if I wanted to join in on this meeting so they could kind of see me, who I was, and see if I was,
Right.
someone to hire. I was the only one who understood anything that he talked about. So they realized that. And I wasn't very big in the diffraction, but I knew enough, and it was, I could understand it enough, and so that I understand what he was talking about, and I could ask all the questions that was clearly relevant. So they said, "All right, you should do this." And this guy was he was he's very good, and he became a very good friend of mine. He's one of those who had beam times everywhere. Like he had applied for beam times in England, in Germany, in France, and so on. And so he asked, but he was kind of a traveler, so he wasn't really stationed anywhere at that point.
He was basically following the bean time, basically.
Kind of, and yeah, looking at that point, kind of looking for a place to get a position. And he later on would work very heavily both in Max4 and the ESS project. He said, "Hey," after that meeting or end of that meeting, we were just talking, and it's like, "Hey," he realized that I knew anything or I knew something. So I have a lot of beam times, or I have a couple of beam times. Would you be interested in joining me as a collaborator or at least just a worker?" And it's like, "Here we go again. This is what I do best."
Exactly. Jump into the beam time once more.
It's like, "Was it I supposed to do calculations?" So it ended up being that I did that. And that was brilliant because the project kind of grew very fast because of that. No one else could do that. So to be able to be involved with techniques that would very soon end up being Max4 and ESS in Lund, obviously it was going to be very interesting to any department. And I was the only one there who happened to be hired doing something else, who kind of could join into that. And very quickly I would apply my own BIM time. So very odd way around, I did do some DFTO calculation, yes, but I end up being more of a supervisor and a worker and a project leader, a PI, for a lot of the projects around mainly this hydride embrittlement for a while. Now I'm going back, so now I'm basically back again to surface science again. We have managed to get in some staff that are working with surface science, very similar to what I did in the beginning, my PhD days. So now I kind of like, oh, someone else doing that. Now I'm going to want to do that again. So at this present state, I'm actually drifting back into that my old topic, but I'm not. It's just there now.
Yeah, but in a way, basically, so you manage by luck and again observation to end up in the in a very similar, or not, I shouldn't say similar, but you end up in an environment that reminds you of the things that you were doing, right? So you have the right tools to basically attack those questions in a way.
I was just, it's easy. I feel almost ashamed to say I was lucky. But yeah, of course, we're all, either something happens and it's luck. But at some point you realize, well, I guess I'm just one of those person who, yes, I was at the right person at the right time and right place and all that kind of stuff, or lucky enough, I feel like. But obviously there are some kind of personal qualities, hopefully, that are involved with this. Now coming back is that I always like to be very social and I like to try new things.
This is actually the part where Jacob and I decided to have a small pause. And we would like to thank you very much for following our conversation around science. And then we direct you to our episode 2, where we really concentrate mainly on martial arts. So, again, thank you for listening. And if you're interested in our discussion about martial arts, please just go to episode 2 with Jacob, martial arts.